So the question of the Christian's use of time. Perhaps an obvious passage to turn to just to direct our thinking is in the book of Ecclesiastes. Don't often turn to Ecclesiastes together, not in church anyway. Perhaps it's your favourite reading, I don't know. But this section of chapter 3 of the book of the preacher telling us about just how empty life is under the sun. And that if that's all we look at, if we keep our eyes fixed on this world, then really nothing much makes sense. Nothing has ongoing value. And he comes to this great poem, which is perhaps familiar to us in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. I haven't got the number in the church Bibles, just keep flicking through it. Thank you, 670. It's there roughly in the middle of the Old Testament. Ecclesiastes 3, there's a time for everything. And a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What does the worker gain from his toil? I've seen the burden God has laid on men. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there's nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toil, this is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that men will revere him. Whatever is has already been, and what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. And I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked. For there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. Well, that reading's all very well, but time seems to be the one thing that none of us has enough of, if you ask anybody anyway. In spite of all the devices that we've developed over the past half a century or more, we probably feel we've got less time than previous generations. Doesn't make sense, does it? How can women complain when they've got hoovers and washing machines and all these other things, and yet they don't have time? And I won't even go to the men. It's interesting, isn't it, that we find we have such a problem with finding time. Considering the number of books there are, if you go to any bookshop or onto Amazon or somewhere like that, look up efficiency and time management, and you'll find there's just no end to the list that's available. It's a big subject, and needless to say, we don't have time this evening to talk more about it. But how do we juggle all the demands? Everyone struggles, don't they, with trying to balance the demands of home life and family life and social work, personal needs. And of course, for us Christians, it's made even worse because we've got to add the church in there sometime. One of the comments I think I'm most likely to hear about any new initiative that I might suggest or we might come up with as a church is, well, I just haven't got the time. So before we consider the practicalities, it might be helpful to ask one or two preliminary questions. For example, what is time? Seems a silly question, but I can assure you that we spent many tutorials in our philosophy classes at college discussing this question. Benjamin Franklin said, "Don't squander time, for that is the stuff life is made of." What's the trouble is that the time isn't a concrete thing, is it? It's more like a measure. Indeed, in our experience, it's a measure that's rather elastic. The story is told of a father whose son was a physicist, and the father asked the son to explain Einstein's theory of relativity. And so the son said, "Well, you see, Dad, it's like this. When you're in a dentist's chair, a minute seems like an hour. But when you have a pretty girl on your lap, an hour seems like a minute." The father pondered the explanation for a while and then commented, "So you're telling me, for saying things like this, Mr. Einstein made a living?" Well, I think the theory of relativity is slightly more complex than that. But it's true, isn't it? Time is relative. And it depends on what we're doing and who we're doing it with and what the weather's like as to whether time flies or time goes slowly. Compare 5 minutes waiting for the bus in the rain with 5 minutes in the same queue with a friend next to you and the sun shining. It feels totally different. The same length of time has elapsed, but how different it feels. One certainty about our experience of time, though, is that it is definitely limited. What do we say? There are only so many hours in a day. There's only so many days in a week, only so many weeks in a year. And one remark which is heard is, if only we had more days in the week, and I say, thank the Lord we haven't, because we just fill them up as well, wouldn't we? Why not just add a few days, though? Why have we just stuck to seven? Well, where did the measure come from? The scientists explain that the time is measured by the sun and the moon and the stars. A day is the rotation of the earth, isn't it? And the month has to do with the moon's phases, or it did originally. And when it comes to a year, that's the rotation of the earth around the sun. And so as Christians, we say, well, perhaps that then is exactly how God intended it. Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 to 19 tell us that when God created the world, he created it good. And he created the sun and the moon and the way that it all hangs together. So that complaint that there just aren't enough hours in the day or whatever actually brings with it a rather dangerous implication, doesn't it? It suggests that God got it wrong. God could have managed things a bit better. He didn't give us enough time. And so this is where I think we always have to start, that God's view is that we have the right measure. God has given us enough time, and that's a good place for us to begin. Indeed, the Bible assures us that God himself is over time. He sets things as they are. Human beings might have been appointed to govern the world, but the sun and the moon govern time, day and night, seasons. Well, that's time as a measure. What about time as we experience it, though? The view of Eastern religions being adopted by many in our world today through New Age ideas is that time is a circle. And what we experience already has been experienced and will be experienced again in the future. It's just a continual cycle that we're in. The Bible is plain about the fact, though, that rather than being circular, time is linear. Or maybe we could say it's like a spiral. There is a certain repetition of events in some way, but never exactly the same. That is that we live in time not only governed by the sun and moon, but moving in one direction, from one event to another event and on through that to another. Various points reaching a conclusion. Time is marked by events. That's why we find those helpful timelines used by historians telling us the events that occurred, so that we can see that the way that time has been used. And it's demonstrated by the way in which God has revealed himself through the Bible, in the form of a historical revelation, rather than just a collection of statements or philosophical, mystical, philosophical, mystical nature. God has stepped into time, the Bible tells us. He's come onto the stage. Well, you might think that's all a bit vague. I don't know how that's going to help me do the jobs I need to do next week. But it does make a practical difference, you know, how we view time. Because the Eastern view leads to the conclusion that time really doesn't matter. If you miss it this time round, you'll get it next time round. And that's true of life, because of reincarnation, you can just try better next time. Each moment will be returned to, and we're caught in a wheel that we can't escape from. So there's often little struggle, perhaps, for improvements, if that is your philosophical view of life. But if we take on board what God has revealed, that time moves from one stage to another, each event, each moment becomes unique, never to be repeated, and is moving towards a definite conclusion, while at the center of time, of course, stands a cross. What is time? Well, what about the importance of time then? All of that gives us justification for believing that there is a real importance to time. We should take it seriously. We can't just think, well, I'll get it all over again one day. And some of that importance has been brought out by one of the great thinkers of the Puritan era, a man called Jonathan Edwards, who had nothing to do with triple jump or gold medals. He lived a bit before that one. He made a number of the following points in a sermon, which he easily and nattily entitled The Preciousness of Time and the Importance of Redeeming It. But he did come up with some very good pointers, I think, which can help us. First of all, he said, time is short. I hope that I've got the right. I didn't have time to check all these beforehand. But let's just read these verses. James chapter 4, verse 14. It says, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Time is short. And, of course, the scarcer something is, then the more valuable it becomes, doesn't it? Think of oil. Even the longest life is short in comparison to eternity. Time is short. That's one reason why it's so important. Also, we can see, he says, that time is passing. First letter of John, 1 John chapter 2, verse 17. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever. We might say we can save time, but of course you can't, can you? You can't say, well, this week I've got a bit of spare time, so I'll put that somewhere and use it next week when I'm going to be busy. It doesn't work, does it? We can't save time. We can't buy time. We can't make time. We can only seek to use it wisely. Time is passing. Time is also uncertain. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 11. No, sorry, verse 1. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. Time is uncertain. Don't worry, I'll do it tomorrow. Who knows whether we'll have tomorrow? How many people in central China thought they would do things tomorrow and found that they had a very different situation they were facing? Time is uncertain, isn't it? Time lost can't be regained. John chapter 9, verse 4. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. Those lost moments will never return. How many people have regrets when loved ones pass away? If only I could have them back and say this or do that. Once it's gone, it's gone. Romans 14:12 tells us that we are going to be held accountable for our time. Romans 14, verse 12. So then, each of us will give an account of himself to God. What a sobering thought that is. How have you used your time? We perhaps expect God to ask us how we used the gifts he gave us, how we used the money he blessed us with, how we used the people he surrounded us with. But have we stopped and thought God will ask us how we used our time? Do we think we have time ourselves that's just for us? Oh, that's mine. I went to church on Sunday, so Monday I can do what I want. That's the pastor's problem, perhaps. We're accountable. We're going to be held accountable for our time. Time is so easily lost. Proverbs 26, 13 and 14. The sluggard says, that's a lovely word, isn't it? Sluggard. Don't you just love that? The sluggard says, there is a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming the streets. As a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on his bed. Is that how you feel on a Monday when you have to get up? You know, the creaking as you turn over. You're lying, sitting in the house, and you know you've got to go out and cut the grass, and your wife asks you to and say, oh no, there might be a lion in the garden. You know, I better not go out today. Time is so easily lost. You know, except for the fool, nobody is more severely criticized in the book of Proverbs than the sluggard, the horror of laziness. Also in Proverbs, the fact that time leads in one direction for us, and that is the direction of death. Chapter 5, verses 11 to 13 of Proverbs. At the end of your life, you will groan. That's positive, isn't it? The end of your life, you will groan when your flesh and body are spent. You'll say, how I hated discipline, how my heart spurned correction. I wouldn't obey my teachers or listen to my instructors. I've come to the brink of utter ruin in the midst of the whole assembly. The end of your life, you will groan, and it's coming. In his dying words, the famous French non-believer Voltaire said to his doctor, I will give you half of all I'm worth if you will give me 6 more months of life. But of course, you can't buy it, can you? So desperate were his cries when it came to the end, apparently, that his nurse said, for all the wealth in Europe, I don't want to see another unbeliever die. And it isn't just the French who are like that. Similarly, the last words of the English skeptic, Thomas Hobbes, if I had the whole world, I would give it to live one day. But time brings us to death. It's inevitable. And one final point from Jonathan Edwards. It leads to eternity. We should, therefore, use time to prepare for that endless time of eternity. 2 Corinthians Chapter 6 and verse 2. God says, in the time of my favor I heard you. In the day of salvation I helped you. I tell you, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. Time is coming when we will have no other opportunity. We should prepare now, in this time, for eternity. They're the thoughts of Jonathan Edwards particularly. But perhaps rather than giving us helpful warning, it's this sense of the importance of time simply leads to petrifying fear. If it's so important, then I just don't know how to deal with it. The future. What will happen? It comes too fast. The non-existent present. It's gone as quickly as it came. When is now? By the time I've said now, it's gone. It's past. And until I say it, it's not there. There's nothing in the present, is there? And then there's the irretrievable nature of the past. We can't change it, though it makes us what we are. What can we do? How can we manage this slippery reality of time? I think one of the greatest ways that we can approach that as believers and Bible-believing people is by looking at the value of the patterns that God gives us. See, God gives us his guidelines for life in the most practical way in the Old Testament. The structures for life which he gave to the people of Israel point to the wisdom of a pattern. We see it in the instructions for their society concerning patterns in the weekly and the annual structures of their lives. These patterns appear to be flexible but are ignored at our peril. We can go against them. We can think, well, I don't need to do that. But we will suffer. You see, unlike the sun and the moon, which have no freedom or personal reality because they're inanimate. They're stuck in their orbits. Unlike them, we were made in the image of God. We have a freedom of moral choice. Not least is that shown in our creativity. But how often we use our creativity wrongly. We use it to overrule the sun. But we need care in this, otherwise we ourselves will burn out. Day and night are given us for a reason. There is a wonderful sense in which to use the dark hours for recuperating is great. I've just finished reading the biography of Ranulph Fiennes, the explorer. And he did that ridiculous idea of seven marathons on seven continents within 7 days. I don't know if you remember that a few years ago. Nearly killed himself in the process, but there you go, that's explorers for you. But one of the problems he had was that when he was running in Sydney, and it was quite an easy race, he couldn't understand why his body wasn't doing what it should do. And then he worked out that his body clock was saying it's night. And so he just wasn't functioning as well as he could. Within a few hours, he was running in Singapore and found it was fine. But by then, his body was saying, oh, it's morning now, so you can do a bit more. I mean, it didn't help with the blisters and stuff. But we ignore day and night at our peril. We're going to suffer if we do that. And if day and night are the most basic pattern built into creation, another one that God has given us is one day in seven, isn't it? I believe that much of our sense of loss of control regarding time is due to ignoring the importance of following the basic pattern that God has given us. If we want to manage our time well, then this is best done by sticking to the pattern of the one who made us and explained it to us. So perhaps we come to it. What does that mean in practice? Well, at its most basic, as I've just said, day and night are ignored at our cost. How many parents try and explain to their children, burn the candle at both ends and it will catch up on you. You'll end up getting burnt yourself. Of course, we're not slavishly bound to it. We can cope for for short periods, perhaps, particularly when we're young. There was a period when I would go to bed at 3 because I had a wonderful woman to go and meet. I married her to get around that problem. And then I'd be up at 6 trying to learn the stupid language that she spoke. And I did it. I mean, not learn the language particularly, but I managed to live in those sort of hours for a matter of months anyway. When you're going through the demands of being young parents or parents of a young child, you find that you do actually get through somehow. But we need to keep an eye on it, don't we? We aren't slavishly bound, of course. But how silly to act as if we weren't made for the pattern that God's laid down. What does the constant ignoring of these patterns say about our culture? Do we love darkness rather than light? Oh, I'm a night person. I wonder what we mean when we say that. And with this pattern, eventually, our body will demand that we take note. And we'll say, it's time for an early night. It's time for a stretch of early nights if you want to be of use for me in the day. It's an interesting comment that some of us noted that Rico Tice made at the London Men's Convention. I can see a few people nodding and remembering that. And he said that if he went to bed after 11 o'clock, anybody would know, I think it was 11 o'clock, anybody would know that he had decided not to pray the next day. Because he said, realistically, he wouldn't be able to. He'd be too tired in the morning, and the day would go by. I wonder if we're willing to be as honest with ourselves as that. What time do we go to bed before we want to do something useful for God? The other of God's patterns, of course, is most under threat, however, because its pattern is of more spiritual benefit than perhaps biological or physiological benefits. And that's the pattern that in the Bible is called the Sabbath. Why institute the Sabbath pattern? It sounds so much like legalism, isn't it? Oh, we've got to observe the Sabbath. But Jesus was adamant, wasn't he? Sabbath is made for man. It's made for our good. This pattern, too, is there to help us. It's always been the temptation of religion, of course, to make a rule of it, to make it legalistic, and to try and tie things down with that. But it is there for our benefit. And most especially, we were created with the need for rest and for worship. We were created to live generally according to routines, but for those routines to be broken at intervals for refreshment and rest. Recognizing that was, I think, the positive contribution of what years ago was done with the Keep Sunday Special campaign at the height of the debate on Sunday trading. It was trying to say that allowing Sunday trading was making impossible, unattainable, living by this pattern for the most vulnerable in our society. The very ones who wouldn't be able to choose whether they worked on a Sunday were the very ones who would most need it. But what about ourselves as believers? Well, it's all a matter of priorities, of course, isn't it? The truth is that we all find time for what we think is important. Don't ask a person what they think is important. They will know the right answers, particularly in a church, a well-taught church. Well, God and family and work and pleasure, perhaps that's sort of a sliding scale. We say we know that that's the right order. But rather than ask them, as we saw last time, perhaps we should look at their bank statements. What do they actually spend their money on? Or, regarding our topic today, look at their diary. What do they fill their time with? Often we can avoid spending real time with God by sounding super spiritual, can't we? Well, it all belongs to God, we say, meaning that in practice we don't set any time apart for him. Well, I'm spending time with the family, I say, which can so easily become, I'm going to do what I want. Well, I'm providing for my family, we might say, which simply means I'm staying longer at work because I want to get on and fulfill my personal potential. Or maybe to avoid coming home in time to put the kids to bed and help with the washing up. If we're serious about managing our time, we need first to ask, what are my priorities? How do I win the constant battle between the urgent and the important? Perhaps we should treat our time as we would be wise to treat our finances, and regularly, perhaps at least twice a year, review how our time is spent. Some time ago, I said I'd set aside one evening a week to just sit and read God's word for a couple of hours in a block. Am I doing that? Have I kept to that? Am I ready to review how I spend my time? Perhaps we need to talk it through with a friend and say, let's be accountable to each other. Let's see if we can change the way we use our time to be more in line with a pattern that God seems to have set down. Is the important being ignored? Does the urgent rule? Perhaps most especially, am I setting my time clock according to God's wise pattern? We all have a real need for sleep and for rest. One day in seven should be different. And a change really is as good as a rest. Doesn't mean sitting and putting your feet up, necessarily. It's a great area as well of responsibility, isn't it, for the training of our children. I don't just mean if you've got actual little children, but as church adults, children look at us. Let's not forget that in the commandments it was given 6 days labour as well as one day rest. We must get the balance right, bearing in mind our characters. Am I by nature a workaholic, tempted to do 7 days labour? Or am I by nature a sluggard, tempted to do 3 or 4 days labour, and then the rest is yours, God. But in the busyness of our lives, how important it is not to neglect the opportunity to invest in eternity. Making our church life a real priority, that we might serve together and learn together and reach out together. The priority of the Christian life, you see, is all about relationships. Not our rights, but our duties to those that we're concerned for because we know God is concerned for them. Relationship, first of all, our relationship with God. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? Is that reflected in the way we use our time? Do I want to develop? Am I laying up treasure in heaven? Is he really the most important person to me? Do I come to him through Jesus and want to work that out in every area of my life? Relationship with our family, and I think biblically that means both our natural and our church family. How can we say we love God if we hate our brother? We're asked in Scripture. And then also relationship with the world. We're called to be witnesses. Witnesses by our lives and at times by our words. And that should mean that as far as number three goes, we don't do anything that undermines number two and number one. And in respect of three and two, we don't do anything that undermines number one. Our relationship with God must come first. As far as my personal experience goes, what I value looking back to my upbringing, a number of things. Bedtimes were important. Most acknowledge that, but what about Saturday's effect on Sunday? How many people come to church and I say, well, how are you today? And say, oh, I'm exhausted. Oh, I was up till such and such last night. Oh, I don't. And you just think, well, who was in charge of that? Did you want to come to church and feel that you would fall asleep in the sermon? Might be my fault, but it might be yours as well. How much do you want to receive from God on a Sunday? And does that reflect in how you use your Saturday? When I was at home, the value of Sunday was never doubted. And so we were never allowed to do homework on a Sunday. Hey, suddenly the back row's all perking up. But it was a relief. It did mean that Saturdays were particularly pressured because I was being told I had to get it done because there wouldn't be any opportunity after today until Monday morning when it had to be handed in. What about the importance of church fellowship, our need to learn and share and pray with others? That was something that was never questioned when I was brought up, and I'm grateful for that now. I perhaps didn't appreciate it very much at the time, but now I think it was very good. I grew up with a sense of the privilege of meeting others, that hospitality was part of it. Yes, it was a day that was different from the other six, but it didn't mean that we just sat at home and dozed all day. Looking at our priorities can often be the start of sorting out our time management. Where are the true priorities of believers who come when all else fits? Who never manage to make the prayer meetings? Who rarely are present at communion because it just doesn't quite fit in? If we're finding managing our time difficult, perhaps it would be good to go away and keep a specific record for 1 week. Actually write down more or less exactly what you do hour by hour throughout that week and look back at it afterwards and say, is that how I want my week to be? Are there things I can do to change? Notice when we've wasted time and therefore lost time. Talk it through perhaps with someone else, along with plans on how to improve it, and be radical. Maybe some of those television programs have to go. Maybe we need to put some mechanism into place to deal with that daydreaming, which can eat up hours within a month. I say that to myself. Maybe give up some activity that so much more valuable ones can be put in its place. Maybe refuse that promotion or even change that job. If we were told that we were in imminent danger of a heart attack, or even when we merely realize that we put on a few extra pounds, we suddenly find that we can be so tough on our bodies, exercising, dieting. What of the way we use our time? What if that's led to spiritual flab building up? How are we ensuring that our treasure is truly in heaven? We need to use time wisely. One final Bible passage, Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15 and 16. Be very careful then how you live. Not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. So I'll just finish with one quote, final quote from John Edwards. In his diary, he wrote one day, resolved, that I will live so as I shall wish I had done when I come to die. Resolved. I will live so as I shall wish I had done when I come to die. How sad if we reach death and are aware enough to look back with nothing but regrets. We have an opportunity, perhaps, as we look at this subject this evening, to resolve. I want to live from now on in such a way that when I come to die, I'll be glad that was how I lived.